Hello, and welcome to the UN Human Rights Podcast, Dignity, Freedom, and Justice for All, commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm Kaloy Henry from the UN Human Rights Office, one of the hosts of this special season of stories. In this episode, we take a closer look at the idea of the right to support and care, as well as an interview with a self-proclaimed troublemaker when it comes to standing up for human rights. All this and more. Stay tuned. And now for our thematic discussion. This episode, we're taking a look at the support and care agenda. Now, support and care are something that we all need. It helps us to participate in society and live with dignity and choice. Yet for far too long, support and care has fallen on the shoulders of women and girls who have been relied upon to care and sustain families, communities, even societies. And for older people and those living with disabilities have been treated as passive receivers of care with no real thought to their agency. So what can be done to improve and better engage with the support and care agenda? In discussion, we have two experts who can answer just this. Catalina Devandes is the Executive Director for the Disability Rights Fund and the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. She's in discussion with Facundo Chavez, Human Rights and Disability Advisor for the UN Human Rights Office. Facundo starts off by asking Catalina why, when she was Special Rapporteur, did she focus so much on the care agenda?
Because without support, there's no real inclusion. That's the short answer to that. There's no way for persons with disabilities to live in their communities of choice, as support is the main enabler for many people, not only for people with disabilities, I will say for everybody. And we have to remember, and this is important, that our communities, our societies as a whole, were designed to support its members, right? But support has been so institutionalized that we don't notice anymore, right? But schools, public transport, healthcare, libraries, roads, you name it. Our infrastructure as a society, it's part of the support network that we have created. But we don't see that anymore because it's just fully integrated. But for some people, older people, people with disabilities, children, it seems that the support was never considered. It has been automatically delegated to some members of the community, for instance, women, and it has been considered as an add-on, as part of the, of course, power dynamics, as part of exclusionary systems and societies. So our support, the support that many of us need, was not included in the initial design of our societies. The second reason why support is important is because even if we work, in the case of persons with disabilities, in building more accessible environments, and we focus on universal design and make sure that goods and services can be accessed by everybody, there's always going to be people that will need support. Support to get out of their houses, support to eat, support to get dressed, support to communicate. And we need to provide that support to make their rights a reality. So that it's fundamental. It's an enabler.
Thanks, Catalina. I think that's exactly the point of this conversation, right? How we make our societies more supportive of those that need support. Current discussions around the issue of support and care tend to portray women mainly as caregivers on one hand, persons with disabilities, older persons and children, only as passive receivers of care on the other hand. What risk you foresee in the efforts to transform support and care systems if this tendency continues?
The risk is that we will perpetuate exclusion and discrimination. The whole review or the revision of this agenda won't serve its purpose. If we don't have adequate support to persons with disabilities, we won't enable their independence, their inclusion, or even their productivity. If we don't do that, first of all, the efforts won't be sustainable. And second, we will not actually reduce the current needs of a family or of a household or of women, as you mentioned, within their families if we don't work in parallel and in consultation with these other groups.
What do you think that the agenda means? What is the support and care agenda? Why is it coming up?
One of the reasons, and you mentioned that already, was COVID, right? I mean, the COVID showed us very clearly the failures of the existing care systems for older people, for people with disabilities, but also how the whole system fell apart while we were in the lockdown, right? We need to have, and I think that was very clear after COVID, we need to address these new challenges with a new policy imagination. What we have witnessed is that the current system, it's absolutely broken. The numbers of deaths, the level of segregation, discrimination, ill treatment, sometimes even torture that people face in these services that are now in place. We know that people lost their lives in a disproportionate manner, not because they were sick or not because they got COVID, but because of the conditions in which they were living and in which the conditions that they were receiving care. That was the actual ingredient that made that very clear. And it is, of course, it goes, of course, hand in hand with the long-standing fight and struggle of the women movement in recognizing that because support has not been incorporated as a basic part of our societies, it has been unofficially charged to women without any recognition.
We are discussing the deficiencies in current care systems, particularly affecting those that are facing discrimination. How can the transformation of support and care systems should address the inequalities that these particular populations face?
I mean, the first point, and I think the main point, we need to make sure that people that is receiving services sits at the table and participates in this reinvention of how this support will work. We need to bring the support closer to the communities. We need to start talking about community-based support, support that is there to promote inclusion and participation and not support or care that is provided to segregate or to isolate people.
And definitely voices, it's an important part, right, of designing human rights-based systems. The slogan of the disability rights movement is "Nothing about us without us." To enable true transformation of support and care systems, whose voices are still missing in current debates, who should join forces in this effort?
Well, when I was a special rapporteur, I started saying actually nothing without us, right? And I think that applies across the board. We cannot longer afford to exclude people, and that's at the core of the SDGs, and I think at the core of any social justice and human rights endeavor. And it's the only way, I mean, inclusion and participatory approaches, and participatory approaches are the only way to move forward, the only sustainable way to move forward. We need to make sure that we make the circle bigger to let everyone in. And it is incredible, I think, that at this point, in this time and age, the end users of care, of the care system, of the support systems, are not being consulted or are not being included on the type of support they want. We would not invest in developing any other policy without having the end users engage in making sure that, because we can design very beautiful things that will not fit the purpose. I always use this example of a boy in Costa Rica, in my country, where he couldn't walk. And so the whole community organized and they were very happy joining forces to get him a wheelchair. And they did all of this in secrecy so that they could surprise him. But he lived in a rural area. And when he got the wheelchair, the whole community was there, the mayor, everybody, you know, and he started crying because he didn't want to have a wheelchair. He wanted to have a horse. That was the only thing that could get him around in his community. So I think that's why we definitely need to have all of them, all of these, the people that you mentioned, engage in a conversation that it's going to bring us closer to a system of support and care that is needed for everyone, for children or older people, people with disabilities, but also for women, for parents in general. So
thanks, Catalina. So this is the 75th anniversary year of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What relevance does the UDHR have for the support and care agenda?
Well, all the relevance. I mean, and you go across every single article of the Universal Declaration and you will find how it is relevant to the support and care agenda. As I said at the beginning, the lack of support, it's constitute discrimination. With support, we enable people to enjoy human rights. Without support, we are putting lives at risk. So we can go to Article 2 of the Declaration. Article 3 when we're talking about life, and then 2 when we're talking about discrimination, of course. Then without support, we are also risking freedom from torture. We can go to Article 5 or even mention, you know, the ill treatment that people can receive in institutions. Of course, legal capacity that is fundamental for people to decide on the type of support and the places where they want to be residing, if they want or not to be in certain type of services, including psychiatric facilities, for instance. And then you move on and everything will be fundamental. Access to justice, freedom of association, going again to this idea of we have, as communities, as societies, designed whole support systems to make sure that people can access justice, that can exercise freedom of association. We have created education tools, infrastructure, etc. We will need to also take into account what is the kind of support that is needed for people with disabilities or older people to enjoy these rights. And the Universal Declaration continues to be a fundamental tool for us moving forward in addressing these challenges.
Thank you, Facundo and Catalina, for that interesting and inspiring discussion. And now it's time for a segment we like to call Stand Up for Human Rights, where we feature a human rights defender telling their story of activism. Renew Odwalla is a 24-year-old Nigerian activist who gained media attention for her organization of protests to end police brutality in her country. A brand influencer, media strategist, and entrepreneur, she has many titles. But how would she describe herself? She's interviewed by UN Human Rights Office's own Christine Wamba.
I think I call myself a part-time troublemaker, to be honest. However, seriously, I am the project director of Connect Hub NG. Connect Hub is a human rights platform and a citizen-centered community of young people who are defending, documenting, and advocating against state violence in Nigeria, especially when it has to do with police brutality.
How did you get started in your human rights journey?
I think that the story that got me started was that of Tina Ezekwe. 16-year-old Tina Ezekwe was shot on the evening of the 26th of May by a drunk SARS police officer. This officer shot into a group of passengers sporadically after he tried to extort the bus driver. And Tina died 2 days later. So after Tina was killed in Lagos, I strongly felt an obligation to rise up and do something. So I organized a protest with some of my friends from social media. We headed to the police headquarters in Lagos, I think in June, to lay a complaint. And from there, you know, it has been a roller coaster. Young people in my country have always ended up becoming victims of a failed system where there's no access to justice, no access to job or good health care, just like Tina. So I think that for me, I began on this path of justice, if I was to pinpoint it, to avoid becoming a victim.
You mentioned that the government listens to protests,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you started campaigning online. So a lot of campaigning is being done online. Is that easier than being done in the street?
Social media is one of the few last places where Nigerians can express their opinions freely. The democracy of social media means that the traditional media monopoly has reduced, and young activists and citizens can get their voices heard without being shut down easily or going through the traditional media, which may be government-sponsored. And I think that's why I would say it is great, and if I was to borrow your word, easier for us to use social media to bring awareness to situations that will not get as much coverage as it would before.
There was a campaign with the hashtag #EndSARS protesters. How did that affect you, and what was that about? And I think maybe just for the listeners' perspective, SARS stands for the Special Anti-Robbery Squad.
The SARS unit, Special Anti-Robbery Squad unit in Nigeria, their unit, the special unit of the Nigerian police force, was supposed to combat issues of armed robbery, crimes, and you know, the sort in Nigeria. However, over time, they evolved into the actual criminals themselves. So instead of arresting or combating armed robbery or criminality, like I said, they became the criminals themselves. I think that the earliest time which young Nigerians will say enough was enough was in 2016. And so since 2016 till 2020, it will surprise you to know that the Nigerian government has disbanded these particular units more than four times. But then just like a double or multiple-headed hydra snake, they keep popping up after the government has purportedly disbanded them. So if you were to ask me about the challenges that I face now that I've, you know, provided the context, I think that for me, using my voice to speak out alongside millions of other Nigerian youths in standing up, the Nigerian government responded with intimidation, with harassment, with persecution. I've had my accounts frozen, my passport has been seized, I've been placed on the no-fly list, my education has been altered, series of physical attacks, online troll attacks, cyber attacks. I think my family has been attacked, more intimidation and harassment than I ever imagined will occur. And this did not just happen to me alone. So there's been interference with our ability to voice our opinions, to impart ideas, and also, I've been tagged a terrorist alongside others just for simply protesting in the country.
Despite these challenges you've faced personally, you know, you carry on. What drives you? What inspires you to keep going?
I think that it's hope. What drives me is hope. The hope that not just me alone, but then other Nigerians can get a society where the common man can get justice, you know, irrespective of their status in the society. I explained a bit of context earlier about how the common man in Nigeria do not have access to justice or help simply because, you know, they are nobody, simply because they're common. And so for me, it's that hope that we can finally get a level playing field in our country where people do not have to know somebody to know somebody to finally get access to justice. I think that in overall, it's hoping for the best. So every day I push myself ready to battle. At times I take some rest and I go again. But then it's hope that I can finally get that society where I can thrive in without being afraid.
What does it mean to you, the UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? What does it mean to you? And how does this document, or how is this document important to you?
Well, I think that to me, it means that I'm not standing alone. I'm not going out on a limb yet. That there are organizations, there are people. There is an important historical document that is still relevant today that speaks to the work that I do. The simple fact that there is a recognition of the dignity and equal rights, you know, of everybody in this world, I think gives credence, if I can use that word, you know, to the work that I do. So this fact that human rights are universal, human rights are not just meant to be enjoyed by people in, if I could say, in Antarctica, if there are people there, but then they are also meant to be enjoyed by people in Nigeria, no matter who we are, no matter what we live. And so I could go on and on about I think all in all, 30 articles. The right to life, the right to liberty, free speech and privacy. All of this speak to the work that I do. So I'm glad that we have the anniversary going. It's also another important moment to remind not just Nigerians, not just Nigerian governments, but then the world about the importance and the relevance of ensuring the inalienable rights of humans all around the world.
What advice would you give to other young activists? particularly with how they can stand up for human rights. If you were to say one word, what would you say to them?
I think that I would say that there's no option for stopping, you know. It has always been in response to speaking up, to taking actions, that the world has always changed. And it's a shame that we have to demand for dignity from tyrannical governments around the world who benefit from our indignity. Our societies are all that we have, and we have a right to demand that it works for all of us. Because it's not just about us, it's about our future. It's about our survival. And so for us in Nigeria, the reason why we fight is that we want a future where we can look back and not regret leaving. A future where we can be globally recognized as entrepreneurs, as Nobel Prize winners, as business moguls. A future that we can be proud of. However, that future is becoming increasingly elusive. That future that we've dreamed of is gradually slipping into delusion. One thing young Nigerians want, that activists from Nigerians like me are saying, is that we want to leave. We want to be able to gain most of the opportunities that we have, no matter how little are there, as opposed to our peers from other developing countries. And in order to be able to gain most of the opportunities, we have to be able to leave and not die as a result of some stray bullet from some errant police officers. So what drives me is to have a say in my own future as an activist, to be able to read what I want to read, and the freedom to speak my mind, the freedom to be heard, and the freedom to be listened to. And I think that that's why I'm risking my life, and I'm willing to take that chance.
Many thanks to Renew and Christine for that lively discussion. It's always good to hear about how people can stand up for their own rights and the rights of others. Well, we've come to the end of this episode of Dignity, Freedom, and Justice for All, commemorating 75 years of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Join us next time when we will focus on racial justice and how this concept has both moved forward over the years, but also has a long way to go. If you're interested in joining the commemorations or interested in learning more about the Declaration and the 75th Anniversary Campaign, then please go to our website, www.ohchr.org/get-involved. I'm Kayloy Henry. Thanks for listening.